From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Harvey Weinstein jury finishes a second day of deliberations without reaching a verdict. Then the surprising fallout of what might seem like a victimless crime, the rigging of the McDonald's Monopoly game in the 1990s.
There were family members that just haven't talked since this happened, friendships that were completely ruined, and then companies that completely went out of business and thousands of jobs were lost.
And a new documentary recounts the story of Robbie Robertson and the band. That's today on The Frame. We'll be right back. Today was day two of deliberations in the Harvey Weinstein trial in New York. He faces a combination of five rape and sexual assault charges, but the jury has not yet reached a verdict. Variety senior correspondent Elizabeth Wagmeister has been covering the case and joins us from the Manhattan courthouse where Weinstein is being tried. Elizabeth, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So after 2 days of deliberations, the jury has sent some questions back to the judge. Are there particular points of confusion or areas where they're looking for guidance?
They express confusion and they ask for more guidance from the judge regarding the verdict form and regarding the charges. Now, as you stated, Weinstein is facing five different charges, but it's complicated. There are main charges and then there are charges that he can only be convicted on if the main charges end up in conviction. So there are two women who are the main witnesses. Those women are Jessica Mann, who is accusing Harvey Weinstein of rape in a New York City hotel room from 2013. And there's another woman by the name of Miriam Haley, who is accusing Weinstein of sexual assault in 2006. If neither of those charges result in convictions, then the other charges essentially don't matter. The other charges are for predatory sexual assault, and those have to deal with Annabella Sciorra, who was the first woman to testify, and she has alleged that Harvey Weinstein raped her in the early 90s. So the jury has expressed confusion about that. They have asked twice now, once yesterday, once today, to be given more clarity on what these charges are. So that is where we stand now. The jury has also asked to be reread testimony. It's the rule in court that they cannot read it themselves, so they are actually being brought back into the courthouse and being read aloud hours and hours of testimony. And that was a testimony from Rosie Perez, who was on the stand to corroborate Annabella Sciorra.
There's also been some conversation about the jury and what some defense lawyers have done outside of the jury's earshot. What have those conversations been about?
Yes. So there has been quite a bit of drama in the courtroom. You know, the prosecution has been calling out the defense for speaking to the media. Specifically, there was an op-ed written over the weekend by Weinstein's lead attorney, Donna Rotunno. Now, she wrote a piece for Newsweek, and the title was something along the lines of, jurors should look past the headlines in regards to my client, Harvey Weinstein. Now, the lead prosecutor, Jonah Luzzi, she slammed Rotunno for this, and she accused her of jury tampering. Well, Donna Rotunno told the judge that, no, this is not what she was doing. She was not speaking about the specific jury. She was speaking about the jury system in general. You could read the headline and decide for yourself. But regardless, all that matters is that the judge basically gave the defense a quick slap on the wrist. All they said was, here's a reminder, you know, don't talk to the media about this case, about the jury, about the witnesses. And they moved on. But I have to tell you, I actually spoke to Gloria Allred and her interview. It's now on Variety.com. It just published this afternoon. She is representing three of the accusers. And I asked her about this because I said, you speak to the media quite often. What do you think about Harvey's defense speaking to the media? And she told me it's different. You know, she is an independent attorney. They are the defense and they are defending the defendant and they should not be talking about the jury to the media.
We're talking with Variety's Elizabeth Wagmeister from the courthouse where Harvey Weinstein is being tried. But didn't Harvey Weinstein's defense ask for a gag order involving Gloria Allred?
They did, and that is what makes this all the more ironic that I had just spoken to Gloria. You know, just after I interviewed her, his defense, they were denied, but they did ask for a gag order. They essentially accused her of being a mouthpiece for the prosecution. They said the judge had ruled that the defense and the prosecution cannot speak to the press specifically about this case, about the witnesses, about the jurors. And here's Gloria Allred, and she is speaking to the media, and they're saying she's essentially giving the same messaging that the prosecution would give. As I said, that was very quickly denied.
And it also sounds like the defense still has concerns about one particular juror. What is the issue for the defense involving this juror?
So one of the jurors, juror number 11, actually, she is an author, and she has written a book that is coming out about predatory older men. Now, during the jury selection process, this was not flagged. The defense said that she lied on her questionnaire because she withheld this information. The prosecution said she didn't lie. Underneath hobbies, she wrote novel writing. Well, ultimately, she was seated on the jury. She clearly is still on the jury. At the end of jury selection, when she was seated, the defense actually, they motioned for a mistrial that ended up being denied. You know, I think there have been three motions for a mistrial that have all been denied. But today, after day one of deliberation, the defense brought it up again and asked for her to be removed. That was also denied by the judge, who said she has done nothing wrong.
Elizabeth Wagmeister is a senior correspondent at Variety. She joins us from the courtroom in Manhattan where Harvey Weinstein is on trial. Elizabeth, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on The Frame, a documentary about how the McDonald's Monopoly game was rigged for more than a decade. If you set foot inside a McDonald's any time in the 1990s, or even just saw a McDonald's commercial on TV, chances are you remember the fast food giant's Monopoly game. Game pieces attached to drinks or French fry cartons or inserted into magazines were each supposed to offer a chance to win, anything from a free burger up to an island vacation or even $1 million. But in reality, between 1989 and 2001, the average person had no real chance of winning one of the $1 million prizes. As the new HBO documentary series McMillions lays out, the game was rigged and $24 million in prizes was stolen. A mobster and a former police officer orchestrated the scheme. McMillions is co-directed and co-written by Brian Lazarte and James Lee Hernandez, and it was Hernandez who first came across the story.
In 2012, I was just laying in bed one night before I go to sleep, cruising through Reddit, and I saw a TIL, "Today I Learned Nobody Really Won the McDonald's Monopoly Game." And I loved that game as a kid. My first job at 16 was at McDonald's during the time of all this.
The game Monopoly is back at McDonald's, bigger and better than ever.
This year, there's more prizes than ever.
Kept looking into it, really couldn't find much about it. And I put a Freedom of Information request in with the U.S. government. That took 3 years, a little more, to go through. And then I could contact the FBI agents, federal prosecutor, and the FBI and get rolling.
So there was a criminal trial. It started the day before 9/11, right? September 10th, 2001. So it was kind of lost in the headlines of 9/11. But there was a trial, and there was some evidence and some testimony that came out of that. But you were looking for something beyond that. What were you after in that Freedom of Information Act request?
Like, online, you could find just some general details about it, but I wanted to know who was involved, how they got involved, how this entire thing transpired, because, you know, this crime happened over 12 years. There had to be all these ins and outs of what happened and who was involved, and I really wanted to know all that.
So, Brian, at what point did you get involved?
James reached out to me in the summer of 2017. He had just gotten the FOIA request back and had reached out to the federal agents, federal prosecutor, and they said this was their favorite case, that no one's ever contacted them about it before.
I think they called it a career case, right?
Very much a career case. And so James reached out to me. We had lunch, not at McDonald's. And he said, you know, if you've never played the game, or if you remember playing the game in the 90s, you never had a chance to win. And of course, you know, that's intriguing. And we thought, okay, maybe there's a documentary in this, but do we have the characters to actually support that? Because you can have a great idea, and on the surface, it might be worth pursuing. But if you don't have storytellers who can add not only, you know, their own voice in an entertaining, interesting way and depth to the story, it's not worth pursuing.
So when you talk about characters, there are a number of characters. I want to talk about one character in particular, and that is, you probably know, Doug Matthews,
yep,
who is an FBI agent crossed with a circus performer. He has got more energy.
At the time, I was always looking for an undercover angle, even though I was being told, you don't want that, you don't want that. You know, I was always asking, what about this one? What about this one? Go get the bad guy, right? I wanted to burn down the criminal enterprise.
At what point do you meet Doug, and at what point is it obvious to you that you can tell a lot of the story through Doug?
One of the first phone calls was to Mark Devereaux,
who is the assistant U.S. attorney who prosecutes the case.
Correct. And in the middle of the phone call, Mark said, hey, I'm going to loop in Doug on our call. He was one of the main agents on the case. And I said, all right, cool. And as soon as Doug got on the phone, it was like, who is this guy? And then the way they bounce off each other, it was like Heckle and Jekyll. It was hilarious. And then, of course, meeting him in person, both of them had been in court all day. And then I met them at the FBI office in Jacksonville about 5 o'clock. And we didn't leave the FBI office till about midnight because Doug talked so much.
Was this on camera or this is just informational?
Yeah,
okay.
On camera.
So there are aspects of this story that mirror the movie Argo. And that involves the creation of a fake movie crew, which is basically created by the FBI with McDonald's knowledge to interview, and I'm using air quotes now on the radio, winners of some of the prizes. And these winners have been given winning tickets by a character we're going to talk about in a second. But the genius of that idea is he essentially gets them to describe their made-up story.
Why don't we go back to that day that you won in New Hampshire? And can you just sort of describe the day for us, what you were doing in the morning and at work? And then
it was a summer day. No, I wasn't working. It was Sunday, as a matter of fact. And there wasn't a whole lot of work to do. So, you know, just browsing through the Sunday paper.
So you think about Albert Brooks in broadcast news, you get the picture. This guy is flop sweating. He is so nervous. And it's riveting, but it's also kind of tough to watch, isn't it?
100%. It was important for the FBI to pretend like they were having fun, because they were supposed to be a McDonald's commercial production company. And Amy Murray, who was brought in from McDonald's to work undercover with the FBI, talks about that, you know, specifically in the first episode. And obviously, you know, it's golden material to work with. Just the idea of what they did, you couldn't script it. But, you know, when we first looked at that footage, you don't know really how to feel about it. Do you laugh at this person? Do you feel bad for them?
It's literally like watching a train wreck. You don't know if you're supposed to watch or not. You don't know if you're supposed to feel guilty because this person is being lied to, but they're trying to lie to the FBI. It's just this whole weird sensory overload when you see it.
We're talking with James Lee Hernandez and Brian Lazarte about the HBO documentary series McMillions. There are two Jerrys at the center of this story. Explain who they are and how they connect.
So there is Jerome Jerry Jacobson, and he was the head of security for Simon Marketing, which is the marketing company that ran the game for McDonald's. And then there is Gennaro Jerry Colombo, and he was part of the Colombo crime family, was looped into this entire thing and really helped explode how big this fraud was. Really early on, Jerry Jacobson, he's giving pieces to people he knows, but once he links in with a mob, they have the wherewithal to expand this out quite a bit.
So what is happening is he is able to siphon off the winning pieces, and then he finds recruiters who will find people who will cash those tickets. They'll get some of the money, but they'll pass along a lot to the people who have stolen the tickets.
Correct.
But what they don't anticipate are the tax consequences.
Yeah, it wasn't just that, too. Is a lot of people didn't realize, even when they were going to win, that you didn't get $1 million straight away. It was $50,000 over 20 years.
It was an annuity.
Correct. Most of the people had to pay money up front to get the ticket and then give a piece of some of the years of winnings. And then taxes takes, for something like that, almost half of every time you get the $50,000 check.
Without giving anything away, what happens in episodes 4, 5, and 6, because I've seen them, you talk a lot about the collateral damage, about people whose jobs are ruined as a consequence of what happened inside companies that are tied to this. And I think it's easy for people to imagine this is a quote-unquote victimless crime. People bought a lot of fast food and didn't win prizes, and $24 million in cash didn't go to people who were actually playing the game. But that doesn't seem to be what you're after. You're really after the web of damage.
Yeah, it's easy to look at it, a victimless crime, and also think, well, somebody had to win. All they're doing is redirecting who won.
Also just stealing from McDonald's. Like, it's a billion dollar company.
Not hurting anybody. Yeah. But you have to think of the families and friends that were involved with this. And the reason there were so many recruiters is because how many people do any of us know that you would trust with a secret like this? And a lot of times it was looping family and close friends in and telling these little lies to get people to redeem these things. And then all of a sudden you become a federal criminal. And so there were family members that just haven't talked since this happened, friendships that were completely ruined, and then companies that completely went out of business and thousands of jobs were lost or affected, and it just had a great ripple effect.
So as you're working on this, a Daily Beast article comes out covering some of the same territory, and the rights for that get bought up by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. So now we have the narrative version of the story competing against your documentary. What's the feeling like when that happens? Do you feel like you have to speed things up, that you're always going to be different movies? What's your take on it?
That was it was a really interesting thing because we had been working on that for well over a year, and we got a call from the FBI agents, a couple of them, and federal prosecutors saying, somebody contacted us about doing an article. Are they with you? What should we do? And we were thinking, you know, how many articles come out a day? It's not a big deal. And the article comes out on Saturday, and then on Thursday, I open up Deadline.com and see that the rights have been sold. And after having a full-blown meltdown, Brian and I decided, you know what? We already have this great relationship with the FBI, with everyone involved. Let's finish our pitch, which we were probably about a month away from anyway. We finished it over a weekend, and then we were meeting with Unrealistic Ideas and talking to Archie Gipps and Mark Wahlberg and Steven Levinson on Monday, and we were off to the races from there.
Wow. And didn't Mark try to get the rights to the
It seemed like everybody wanted to get the rights. So what that did, though, in our head, we thought this was always a great idea, but it validated that there was a great interest in the story.
Proof of concept, in a way.
Yes,
exactly.
And it changed our pitch, because our original pitch was, this is the greatest story about McDonald's you've never heard of, and now every network had actually heard of it. But we were so far ahead at that point that we felt like, okay, you know, in this world that we are current, this landscape of media, television, film, podcast, you see stories populate all these different mediums, and they can live together.
James Lee Hernandez and Brian Lazarte are the co-directors and co-writers of the documentary series McMillions. It is on HBO. James and Brian, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Coming up on The Frame, Robbie Robertson talks about a new documentary that tells the story of the band. Robbie Robertson, along with Garth Hudson, are the last surviving members of the band, the heralded group that recorded classic songs such as The Wait and The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. The new documentary, Once Were Brothers, focuses on Robertson and his musical career, including his time with the band. I met Robertson at his studio in West LA not too long ago, and we started by listening to a song from his most recent album called Beautiful Madness.
Oh, it looks like I'm in too deep, and I can't sleep. Now maybe it's the pressure, maybe it's the dope. See, this is all, it's a little bit of both. It's such a beautiful madness.
This is a song that deals with drug addiction. And in your documentary, drug addiction is a huge part of the story of the band, about what happened to Rick Danko, Levon Helm, Richard Manuel, about them becoming addicts. And I'm thinking about that song, about what addiction meant to you and to witness it and what it did to your friends. How do you go about taking something that is that personal and make a song about addiction?
Well, it's interesting now when you look back on it, because back then marijuana was considered the same as heroin. And so because of that, a lot of people thought, so what's the difference? Let's try this, let's try that. We knew nothing about it. We knew nothing about alcoholism. We just thought, don't you think you're drinking a little bit too much? Why don't you cut back? Everybody thinks, oh, I can handle it. And that's what you would hear over and over again. But in this group, there was something about that addiction that really got in the way of our brotherhood and really got in the way of this was a band that if all five members weren't on point, it just didn't work the same. And trying to lift up one side of it that was bent over and everything was a big job, and a hard job, and a heartbreaking job too.
When you guys made Big Pink with a band, it was a novel idea to actually leave the city, hole up someplace, and make music there. And I'm wondering if you've retained any of that, to isolate yourself from outside noise and figure out where you do your best creative work. We're in your studio now. Is it here? Is it somewhere else? How do you insulate yourself in a way that seemed to work so well on that album?
That was a dream of mine, to have a sanctuary. We got a house in the Hollywood Hills, Sammy Davis Jr.'s house, and recorded an album in the pool house there. The record company thought I was out of my mind, but I knew something about these guys that nobody else in the world did. And I knew that if we had our true unique surroundings, that we could go to a place, and when we came out of that place, we had made music unlike anybody else in the world.
That isn't the only thing that happened 50 years ago. You guys played a little concert at Woodstock, and people who've seen the Woodstock concert movie probably don't know the band played at Woodstock. How come you guys didn't make the cut of that movie, and are you on the multi, like 30-some-odd CD set that just came out?
When we went and played, it was at 9 o'clock, the last night of the festival. It was the height of the festival. There was 500,000 people in the audience. And when we got there, you could see that everybody was out there. They wanted to rock. They wanted to rip off their shirts. And when we went and played, it was like somebody coming and doing hymns. It was more of a spiritual. So you saw this go out over the crowd and everybody completely go to a different zone. And say, but we hadn't played hardly any concerts as the band. So then there was cameramen running around the stage and sticking a camera up in your face while you're doing it. But our manager, Albert Grossman, said, no cameras on the stage. We are not going to have that. This is a different kind of thing.
When I watched the documentary, I was thinking not only about how the band sounded, but about how they were a family in many ways. And to watch the film and think about the early deaths of some of your friends and the more recent deaths of people like Levon Helm, what does it feel like to lose a family that way? Because the band breaks apart, you go off and do your thing, but then to lose these people who are so close to you, you're still here, you're still doing music. How does that affect you?
Well, I wrote a song called Once We're Brothers because the idea is hard for me to imagine that I could have lost Richard Manuel, Rick Danko, and Levon Helm. That I could, you know, that part of this brotherhood is gone forever. And it touches a deep part in me, and I needed this therapy or whatever you want to call it. But for me, it was a way to express my love for this brotherhood and these guys that we did such amazing things together.
Robbie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, John.
The documentary Once We're Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the Band is in select theaters starting February 21st. And that'll do it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.